another thing I was thinking, I like that answer a lot, actually. I think that it's a lot people can do, and I think it's important to, you know, make connections between past and present and future. Another thing in relation to privilege, I wonder if you can talk a bit more about things that have been going on in your work with this. And I think I believe, I remember reading that apparently Native people who are organizing with you have been found murdered. And I was wondering if you think you've been spared such a fate because you're a white.
I think very much, yeah. If I was Native, I wouldn't be around anymore. But my position as a white male and also as a, although I don't like the word white at all, of course. I tend to call white people pale because it's it's a more accurate description. White has a whole connotation of purity, which is not accidental. You know, language, part of the system of genocide is that it's a system of language and words as well. And so as a privileged non-Native male, I've been spared the consequences of a lot of these things, and because I've had a lot of public profile. Of course, that doesn't mean that I'm not, that it, you know, it wouldn't happen against me. It just doesn't happen as easily. There's been a number of people, Native people, who are associated with the work we do, who have disappeared and died. One of the best examples of this is a woman called Virginia Baptiste, who is a leader of the Osoyoos people in South Central British Columbia. She came forward about 4 years ago and was working very actively with us to confront the Catholic Church, not only for the crimes that went on in the Cranbrook and other residential schools in B.C., but for the evidence of mass graves that are all over southern British Columbia. And that's something else I wanted to address, the evidence of these mass graves. Virginia actually had the location of a number of sites where children who had died in the residential schools were interred. And she was in the process of taking us to these sites when she was suddenly hospitalized because of a supposed liver ailment when she was in perfect health. And a week later, she died in the hospital. And she had been very vocal that same week in saying that she was going to start picketing the local Catholic Church and, you know, confronting the RCMP for the fact that her own children were being picked up on no charges and beaten very badly in the local jail in Oliver, B.C., by the Mounties. This is all after she began to go public. So there was a lot of pressure being brought to bear on her family, and I believe she was murdered in that hospital. There were two other witnesses in Vancouver Island, Willie Sport and Archie Frank. Now Willie Sport was and this is talked about in my book, Willie was one of the witnesses who were exposed to tuberculosis in a United Church residential school, and he lived to tell the tale because his grandfather broke him out of the school and rescued him. But you know, he's a witness to the practices in that school. And Archie Frank was an elder from Mahouset who had witnessed the murder of a young boy called Albert Gray, who was beaten to death by Alfred Caldwell, a United Church minister, in the Mahouset residential school. So these are two eyewitnesses to murder. And in January 2000, I was going over to film them to get their testimonies on video as part of a documentary we're working on. And both men died that same week in West Coast General Hospital in Port Alberni. So again, these deaths are not accidental. They're happening right at the very moment when people are beginning to go public. And it's not surprising, you know, when Native people hear these stories, you say, well, they go, well, yeah, that's, I'm not surprised, that happens all the time. But a non-Native person, it's kind of a shock. You hear about these stories in, you know, in the third world, but when it's happening in Canada, we need to do kind of a mental adjustment to think, well, any of us are vulnerable. And the only way to stop that is by being even more vocal and standing together more, because our very lives can depend on it. And so I think people have to be aware of that. This isn't just lawsuits being brought against us. There's these kinds of attacks, first against Native people, the living eyewitnesses. In an indirect way, the government and churches are doing the same kinds of murders, because what they're doing is they're dragging out these lawsuits for year after year so that the eyewitnesses die off. They figure that 5 to 10 residential school survivors die every day in Canada just from old age and disease. So by trying to wait these people out and letting them die off, it's also a way of silencing people. And that's definitely part of the legal strategy of the churches and government.
Yeah, it sure is effective so far. I wonder if you can talk a bit more about, explain to us, like, what the evidence you've compiled in your book. I know this is something that many Native people can speak of from experience, and I had a woman on my show 2 weeks ago, Nisha, who was talking about her experience in children and family services, but more specifically residential schools. Can you speak about the evidence you've uncovered as far as the crimes that went on in there. So people know like exactly like, what happened. He spoke a bit of hidden graves and all this kind of thing, and like the reality of how horrific these things actually were.
Well, the best thing people can do is to hear this. I don't like to speak for people. I can relate some of these things, but the voices of the survivors themselves are the most convincing. And if you go to www.hiddenfromhistory.org, there's an audio site there where you can actually, if you have speakers on your computer, you can actually hear the voices of survivors. But to give you kind of some examples, the whole regime in the residential school is one of terror and continual trauma. Children would arrive and immediately they'd be lined up, their hair would be shaved, they'd be covered in DDT powder, they'd be beaten badly, their hair ripped out, and they'd be whipped and flogged publicly if they spoke their own language. They were put in unheated dorms. They were never given blankets. This is a common description. Imagine lying in a dorm by yourself, and it's barely above freezing. You have a single sheet covering you. The food was not only substandard, but actually unhealthy, often filled with maggots. Children often, former children, like people who survived, often describe how they hoped they would, and they would fight in order to get on the garbage detail, because that's the only way they would eat. As they were taking the garbage out, this would be the leftover of food eaten by the white staff members. They would be pouring through the garbage and shoving food in their mouths before they got to the garbage site. And that's the only way they survived. And it's not surprising then, in such a weakened condition, that so many of them would be dying off from pneumonia, tuberculosis, all these other diseases that are really take a toll when people are malnourished and weak. Torture was used on a regular basis. Staff members were often went around with leather belts that were prescribed. They were actually issued to all staff members, and they were expected to be used. Children were often subjected to electric shock treatment. For example, in the Globe and Mail, in 1996, there was a description of an electric chair that was set up in the Catholic residential school in Fort Albany, Ontario. And that's in northern Ontario. And this Edmund Matatawabin, who's a Cree elder now, described how he was put in this electric chair when he was 10 years old and entertained for visiting dignitaries, is the way he put it. That is, church and government people showed up, and he was strapped in and given electric jolts in this chair. As an amusement, not just punishment, but as a source of amusement for these sick people. And as a result, he said he knew of a number of children who died after receiving these kinds of shocks. So the torture was continual. We've documented over 50 different crimes. For example, children having their teeth operated on without painkiller, being forced to beat each other, when children died, being forced to walk by their body, and being threatened that the same thing was going to happen to them. It's just an ongoing litany of terror. Like, just yesterday I was talking to a man who said that he was forced to stand in ice water up to his waist for 6 or 8 hours. If that doesn't kill somebody, it will seriously maim them. He has permanent bladder problems today because of that. So when you look at all these tortures and the murder that went on, you think, how can any of this ever be resolved by a bunch of money? Like, which is the government and churches that did these crimes are defining the whole issue as one of, compensating people with a few dollars, when the whole focus has to be on not the victims, but the victimizers, the people who did these crimes. Where is there a process in place to try the perpetrators? There's nothing. I think in the entire history of after this issue came out in 1996. For the first time, when the lawsuits began, probably 5 to 10 people in total across Canada have ever gone to jail for any of these crimes. And these are pretty low-level people who, sexually abuse kids. But there's hundreds of perpetrators of these crimes, maybe thousands, who have never been brought to trial, and the government and churches are doing everything possible to make sure they don't ever be brought to trial. So for me, that's the issue, not how to even attempt to compensate people, which you can't really. You can never really heal from these tortures. What needs to be done is we have to shift the focus onto the criminals, the people who did these crimes, and make sure they're brought to justice.
Mm-hmm. And I wonder if you can speak a bit more about the program of the Truth Commission, because you have a list of maybe almost 24, I think, different demands. And can you speak about that? Because I find that very inspiring.
Sure. Well, I can actually refer to a few of them. We adopted a kind of a list of goals, and the first most basic goal is to demand from the government of churches to that they publicly reveal the location and the fate of the children who died in the residential schools, and that their remains be brought back to their traditional territories. Also that the declaration of a national Aboriginal Holocaust Remembrance Day on April 15th across the country, and make that a national statutory holiday so that the truth of this Holocaust can be brought every year to the public through you know, education programs. We really want to get this information into the high schools, so, and into the curriculum of universities and schools, so that the next generation can begin to learn these things. That's what we found in countries like Germany. It's the younger generations that are willing to look at the crimes of their own people. And we want to do the same thing in Canada, where the this information gets into the curriculum. So that's part of the purpose of this Aboriginal Holocaust Remembrance Day on April 15th. And we actually ask people to start to plan to organize public events on that day, so that, you know, more and more people can learn about these things. Another thing we want to do is create Aboriginal Holocaust museums across the country, where not only to bring the truth of this out publicly through artifacts and other kinds of evidence, but also to set up actual memorial sites at the location of the older residential schools where the names of the children who died are inscribed. These memorial sites are really important psychologically for people to be able to be told, well, we are acknowledging that these crimes happened and we're remembering the victims. And of course, you know, one of the more basic demands is that there be an international war crimes tribunal convened in Canada to bring to justice the officials of the government, the churches, the RCMP that planned and committed and covered up all these crimes. So there's other aspects. I mean, one of the more contentious things we're advocating is that the Department of Indian Affairs, the Indian Act, and the RCMP all be dissolved, because these were genocidal organizations set up with the clear aim of eradicating another people. So that's one of the things that you know, we're also think it's important to talk about, because they you can't really, like I said earlier, you can't really expect that the very institutions that did these crimes are going to somehow help bring about justice when they're still in place. And I really urge people to read the Indian Act, because it's an amazing piece of racist legislation. There's, for example, in Canada, there's no such thing as a Jewish Act or an Italian Act. But Native people under the law in Canada are not full citizens. For example, the Indian Act can override any other legislation, including the Charter of Rights. Native people who live on reserves, they don't actually own their own land. They have certificates of occupancy, which can be revoked by the Minister of Indian Affairs at any time. So they can be evicted from their own land at any time. This colonial system is still in place through the Indian Act, and so that's why we really think it has to be abolished.
Mm-hmm. We got about 8 minutes left.
Okay.
And I wonder if you want to say, if you have any other points to address here, to wrap things up. I mean, it's still a nice amount of time.
Yeah.
One thing in particular I was thinking of, you address this a little bit, but a lot of people would prefer to look at all these abuses in these residential schools as, you know, just like ill and sick individual abusers.
Right.
And I wonder if you can talk a bit about how this is actually like a systemic thing.
Yeah. Well, you know, it isn't just a matter of individuals. The churches and governments in the courts, when they're brought to trial, they try to make that argument. They throw out scapegoats like Arthur Plint here in Port Alberni, who was a Durham supervisor, and he went to jail for molesting kids. So they try to scapegoat individuals while not looking at, A, the whole system that was in place to do it, and, B, how the churches are, and especially are still, as an organization, actively covering up these crimes. And so, you know, an example of that is the fact that in one of the cases, notorious cases that brought a lot of this stuff out, was there was a trial in Nanaimo, B.C., in 1998, and a lot of the survivors of the Alberni Residential School were there, because the 15 men were suing the United Church over this. What happened is that the United Church lawyer was badgering these people on the witness stand, saying, well, you don't really you didn't really go through this, did you? You're just making it up because you don't like the church. Well, as a result of that badgering by the church lawyer, two men took their own life. Well, supposedly took their own life. They were found dead during the trial, one floating in the harbor and the other had was found in a hotel room, directly because of, you know, the kind of psychological badgering and abuse they were faced on the witness stand by the church lawyer. And this is common. Church lawyers regularly try to destroy people. It's like the torture and abuse is continuing, only now in a courtroom, where the churches are able to just ravage their victims like this and stop them from talking. It's all designed to silence them. Well, as a result of these two men taking their own life or dying, the church admitted publicly for the first time that they had actually kidnapped these children into the school. They had not obtained any kind of permission from their parents. They acknowledged that the children were brought there illegally. And also, the other thing that came out is that they acknowledged that since 1960, the United Church and the federal government had been actively suppressing evidence and stories coming out of the Alberni Residential School. So in other words, for the first time in 1998, the church admitted publicly that they're engaged in a cover-up, an official cover-up with the government. So it shows you that it isn't just the act of individuals. It's a whole system in place where the church is instructing their lawyers and their ministers all over to lie and to cover up and to attack the witnesses. And my story is kind of very important because it shows you what they do to one of their own. Their campaign against me has been merciless. They've done everything from not only firing me and blacklisting me, but they even helped my ex-wife in her divorce action against me, where they helped her get custody of our kids. They've stopped me from getting employment. They've tried everything possible to try to silence an insider like me who is trying to bring out the truth of this. So it shows you that these are even more serious crimes to look at. It isn't just the original crimes, but the continual attacks that they're able to get away with because they're one of the powers in Canada. You know, the church is protected actively by the government, by the courts. And people, the only way you have to resist this is to confront them publicly and pull away the kind of false liberal mask that the United Church and others carry around. They say one thing, but then in practice, it's disgusting the things that they've done and gotten away with.
Mm-hmm. And where are you going from here, Kevin, as far as, like, what's your plan for the next little while?
Well, a number of important things. We're working on a documentary film. We hope to get to different countries so we can, tell the whole story. I've just launched the second edition of Hidden from History, which is 500 pages long. It's got a lot of important evidence. And I really urge people to order copies from me and get them into the libraries and colleges. And I'm actually hoping over the next few months to come east, to Ontario and do more of a speaking tour. So if people are interested, again, I urge them to go to the hiddenfromhistory.org website. And you could also just leave an email for me at Kevin Annett, KevinAnnett, at yahoo.ca. Also, easy way is just to leave a message on our pager, which is 1-888-265-1007. I'll just say that again, 1-888-265-1007.
That's great, Kevin. Yeah, it's heavy stuff. It's heavy stuff, and yeah. I thank you as a... It sounds like a member of such privilege being in this, benefactors of such a colonial process and doing what you can to, undo your privilege and decolonize your own mind. Yeah, thanks for the work you're doing.
Well, thank you for having me on, and I admire your courage in having me on because a lot of people in the media are really afraid to touch the story, and so I appreciate that, and a lot of people who can't thank you do so as well, and I hope that we can work together more to bring this out.
Yeah, hopefully, and I'll talk to you soon.
Okay, thank you, Matt.
Thanks a lot, Kevin.
Okay, bye.
Bye.